Okay, so cuprates are perhaps a little bit off the main track of this workshop, but I sort of picked the subject because I'm quite actively working on it now, and I think there are quite a few interesting developments in the field, both on the side of theory and on the side of experiments. And actually, my talk is going to have both of them, both some theory and both some experiment, and I'll try basically with experiment, start with experiment. Okay, so they're a little bit off the main track, but not quite. Of course, they do have moments. There is magnetism in cuprates. Hi, Nicola. Well, that gives me an opportunity to eat some of your sushi. It does have motness. You know, it's a prototype of a Mott insulator when undoped. It doesn't have too many multiplets because the degeneracy is lifted in these materials by the Jahn-Teller distortion, basically onto a one-band model. But you'll see if I come to that, that at the end of the talk, multiplets come back with a vengeance, actually. So it's not so much off the main track after all. And I'm going to keep the talk really informal, and actually a good half of it will be on the blackboard. Okay, so I would like to start with some basic facts, because not everybody here might be completely familiar with the phenomenology of cuprates and with some of the outstanding puzzles that they pose to condensed matter physics. So I start with some basics, and need to get more chairs. And the basics comes with first with my collaborators. So I've been fortunate to interact recently on the subject with many experimentalists, particularly from a Raman scattering group in Paris, led by Alain Sacuteau, and with quite a few theorists, Gabi Kotlia, with whom I have a long-standing collaboration over many years, and student, former students, postdocs, etc. Okay, so the materials, well, you more or less all know them. They are basically double perovskites, quasi-two-dimensional materials, in which, and I'm not going to do material physics in this talk, so very briefly, we basically have copper oxygen two planes, which are, is there a pointer somewhere? Yeah. Which are separated by stuff which provides basically charge reservoirs for these copper oxygen two planes. So that's perhaps a slightly more clear picture of the unit cell of one compound, which you will hear more about in the following of this talk, which is mercury 1201. And that compound is the member, is a, one of the members of the famous mercury series, which have very high transition temperature. This one is the single layer mercury. So it has only TC equal 95K, but that's still pretty high. And one of the beauty of this material, to which I will come back in a minute, is that it actually has perfect cubic symmetry. There is no orthorhombic distortion, so that actually within the plane, the A and B axis are completely equivalent. And that allows for doing really nice symmetry-sensitive experiments with spectroscopic methods like Raman. I'll come back to that. Okay. So this is basically all I want to say about the detailed chemistry of materials. And I would just like to flash this very well-known phase diagram. So this is doping, starting from the parent compound, which has D9 configuration, and hence and a very big U and charge transfer energy. So this material, these family of materials, are actually Mott insulators, or more appropriately, they're actually charge transfer insulator, where the cost to add or remove an additional electron is actually set not by the Coulomb repulsion, but by the distance between the oxygen and the copper levels. So these guys are strongly correlated insulators, and the fun happens, they're antiferromagnetic with rather high transition temperatures, actually, and the fun happens when you dope them, especially on the whole doped side, which is for example, doping LCO with strontium introduce holes in the copper oxygen planes. And there is a very rich and complicated phenomenology that happens when you do that. Only part of it is sketched here. But basically what happens is that if you look at low enough temperature, there is a superconducting state, which we now know has a D-wave symmetry. We've known that for many years now. And the TC has a dome-like shape as a function of doping, with a maximum somewhere around 15% of doped holes. And that separates the superconducting dome into two regions, the so-called underdoped region, where the doping is lower than this optimal doping, which has many mysterious properties, and the so-called overdoped regions, in which more conventional physics actually starts to come. If we actually look above the superconducting dome in the underdoped region, there is a region which is called the pseudogap phase, on which I will comment more in a few minutes. Okay, so at this stage, this is all I want to show with slides, and now I'm going to show you things on the board. But of course, that doesn't quite work, so let's try something else. Oh, yeah, that should do it. No, still there. Okay, yeah, that's a much better technology, I think. Yeah, that's fine. Okay. So what I want to do now is summarize a few basic facts and a few outstanding puzzles. About cuprates. Okay, so first of all, there are very unconventional methods in the normal state. And that's particularly true in the whole doped, underdoped regime. So when doping is smaller than delta optima. Okay, so let me explain in what sense they are very unconventional metals. Well, that requires, first of all, a little reminder. Okay. A little reminder on what is a conventional metal. And conventional metals are described by Fermi liquid theory. Okay, so what is Fermi liquid theory? Fermi liquid theory is basically. Let's try the screen. Okay, that does it. Now it's all shut. You won't have the rest of the talk. Okay, it doesn't matter. I can do it all on the blackboard. Okay, so Fermi liquid theory is actually a theory of the low energy excitations in a metal, in an interacting metal, and it's particularly nice to present it sort of phenomenologically by describing the so-called spectral function, which is really the measuring the phase space available for either injecting or removing an electron, a physical electron from the outside, into or out of the system. Okay, so that's a very nice quantity because it's directly measurable in angular resolve photoemission experiments. And in a Fermi liquid, what happens is that this guy, as you get the momenta close to the Fermi surface, develops a very sharp peak here at some position psi k, which defines the dispersion relation of quasi-particles. And this psi k has nothing to do with the original bands. It's a dressed object by interaction, and close to the Fermi level is something to be, is going to be like Vf star times k minus kf, with where Vf star is an effective Fermi velocity or inverse of the effective mass of the quasi-particles. And that peak, of course, is not a delta function because that's a quasi-particle. It has a certain lifetime. And this lifetime, whose inverse I will call gamma k, becomes smaller, and this inverse lifetime becomes smaller and smaller as you reach the Fermi surface in a very definite way that I don't want to enter into too many details. But actually, this peak becomes very sharp as you reach the Fermi surface, which means that you have sharp, long-lived quasi-particles as you go to the Fermi surface. So the last bit of information that you need about quasi-particles, besides dispersion relation and lifetime, is their total spectral weight, because in an interacting system, not all spectral weight is in the quasi-particle peak. Some is somewhere out in the incoherent parts. So this peak has a finite spectral weight zk, which is smaller than 1 and possibly much smaller than 1 in correlated systems. And that quantity is called the quasi-particle weight and will play a very important role in the rest of the talk. And of course, we have all sorts of incoherent stuff here, like Hubbard bands and other kinds of excitations that I'm not going to enter into describing. Okay, so that's the sort of cartoon picture of what low energy excitations are in a Fermi liquid. And now I would like to tell you a bit why that's not what's happening. Well, just from experiment, that this is not what's happening in cuprates. Okay, so actually, a very important aspect of cuprates is that there is extremely strong momentum dependence. So if we just focus on the two-dimensional Brillouin zone corresponding to the copper-oxygen plane, we have some Fermi surface that we would expect to be something like this. This is pi, gamma point 0, 0. And LDA, for example, would give you a Fermi surface looking like this for whole load systems. And things behave very, very differently in the normal state if we look at a K point near the diagonal of the zone, or if we look at a K point far from the diagonal of the zone. And this region is known under the name of nodal regions, because eventually in the superconducting state, this is where the superconducting gap will have its node, and hence this is the antinodal region. Okay. So what happens in the nodal region is that nodal regions still have pretty sharply defined quasi-particles. Perhaps not ideal Fermi liquids, but roughly speaking, if you look at ARPES experiments, you have a pretty nice peak with a gamma k, which is perhaps a little bit too big as compared to Fermi liquid theory. But as you move close to the Fermi surface, this disperses all the way to zero energy and becomes reasonably sharp. Also, the z, the spectral weight here at the node, so I will call this z nodal, is sizable and basically, from all we can say from experiment, is proportional to doping, which is something we expect from most theories of a doped multi-insulator. Okay, so I talked about z, I talked about gamma at the node, which is reasonably small, and I didn't say anything about the effective mass. The effective mass doesn't depend too much on k, so Vf star doesn't depend too much on where you are on the Fermi surface, insofar as you can measure it. And this quantity is actually not very small. So in contrast to many doped transition metal oxides in three dimensions, these do not have very large effective masses. The effective mass enhancement typically is about 3, and that also fits what can be measured from specific heat, for example. This is a very rough order of magnitude. Okay, so now if we look at antinodes, so this region here, it's a completely different story. What happens is that there is no quasi-particle for all practical purpose. So the ARPES spectrum looks like a hump like that. And this is very broad. There is no real way you can define a quasi-particle peak. And if you are below a certain characteristic temperature, which goes under the name of T star, it's even more bizarre, because as you try to go closer to the Fermi surface, this guy doesn't go to zero energy, but remains away from zero energy with a certain energy distance here, which is the antinodal pseudo-gap scale. So that's the infamous pseudo-gap, which really means that the leading edge of the photoemission spectrum, for example, doesn't want to reach zero energy. And there is a depletion of spectral weight at low frequency. So it is known that this scale, T star, and the pseudo-gap scale at the antinode behave as a function of doping like this. So this is the parent compound, and this is optimal doping. And this is a scale which is rather large and comes down in energy as you dope more and more from the parent compound. Okay. So you see that one can try to map out along that Fermi surface, or that would be Fermi surface, the region where there is a sizable peak. And when experimentalists do that, they define sort of a region here where there is a quasiparticle. And outside this region, the quasiparticles are gone. And that's the famous Fermi arc, which I will put with some word of caution here, because that cannot be the Fermi surface of the system. That violates everything we know. That violates Schlesinger theorem. This cannot really be. But actually, this is what is seen experimentally from photoemission from a practical point of view. And the size of this arc becomes smaller and smaller as you actually go from optimal doping towards the multi-insulating compound. This thing shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So there are fewer and fewer quasiparticle excitations as you go to low doping. Okay, so that's very bizarre. And this really calls for theoretical approaches that can handle very strong momentum differentiation in the Brillouin zone. And that's the key challenge for theory in this field at that point, is to actually cook up theoretical approaches that can handle a system which has strong momentum differentiations with certain regions of k-space that have well-defined, reasonably well-defined quasiparticles, and others that do not. Okay, so that was the 15-minute cuprate update. And
are there other systems like that, or is that unique?
It's very unique, very unique. I suspect, this is actually a very interesting question, I actually suspect that some of the organic materials, the two-dimensional ones, and probably also the one-dimensional one, the Bechgard salts, do have that physics of hot and cold regions. But unfortunately, it's very, very hard to do photoemission experiments on those because they are plastic, they are destroyed by photons. Okay? So with these very low-energy laser photoemission experiments, we may have surprises in this field. There was proposal based on transport many years ago by Paul Chaikin that these compounds, before cuprates actually, that these compounds would have hot and cold spots. And it may be true. But apart from that speculation, that's the only family of compounds that I know which do that.
One of those is that the energy scales are much smaller.
Right, but we can live with that, right? I mean, five EV lasers. Yeah, that may be a way to go. Okay, so as you see, that sort of defines a list of some outstanding questions. And about the normal state, there are basically two outstanding questions. What is the origin of the pseudo gap? And can we build a theory of strong k-space differentiation? Okay, so now let me turn to the superconducting state. For a while, it's been believed that the superconducting state is a much more conventional animal, but I don't think that's really true, and there is growing evidence that the underdoped superconducting state is also very strange. Okay, so what do we know about the superconducting state? We have symmetry-dependent experiments now, 10 years old basically, that tell you that this has D-wave symmetry. The first simplest harmonic for that is cos kx minus cos ky. And so you see that this guy has zeros along these diagonal directions here, and then maxima there. And so it's a D-wave superconductor. And for a long time, it was actually believed that there is a close connection between the superconducting gap and the pseudo gap. And evidence from that actually came from measuring the leading edge of photoemission experiment in the superconducting state and finding that if you actually measure the antinodal leading edge now in the superconducting state as a function of doping, it's basically also doing something like that. It tracks continuously to the pseudo gap scale, and hence maybe that's the superconducting gap scale. However, this has to be really taken with a grain of salt because it's very difficult to map out the Hoole gap function, the Hoole leading edge, okay, as a function of angle around the Fermi surface, because the scale is very small near the nodes. So this statement applies near the antinodes in the superconducting state. And what's going on near the node in the superconducting state has been the subject of a very active set of experiments over the past year and a half, and I'm going to talk about this next. So the connection between the superconducting gap and the pseudo gap is now being completely revisited, as I'm going to describe to you. And there is growing evidence that these two scales are actually very different and that the superconducting gap is a different scale in this problem. If the superconducting gap was doing something like this, you see that this would be an even, still another puzzle of cuprates, because TC is doing this. Okay? So this would be a case in which the superconducting gap to TC ratio is very non-BCS and becomes huge at low doping. Okay. So now I'm going to tell you a little story which started with Raman experiments about a year and a half or 2 years ago, and which actually revealed that there is more to it. There is more to the superconducting phase near the nodes that was not seen before. And following this Raman, well, about the same time, so a little bit later than these Raman experiments, several pieces of evidence from photoemission also came up. So I'm going to return to slides because I'm going to show experimental data, which I cannot really do otherwise. Okay. So while this guy turns on, let me explain what's going to happen in these slides. So what I'm going to show you are some Raman scattering experiments that have been performed in Paris on these 1201 mercury compounds. And Raman is, of course, a Q equals zero probe of a condensed matter system, because the photons basically live at Q equals zero as compared to the momenta of the electrons. But you can still use information about angular dependence, because you can use the polarization of light. And it happens that if you choose carefully your polarization, you can actually sample the nodes, and if you choose it in a different way, you can actually sample the antinodes. There I go. Okay, good. Hopefully this is reasonably stable. Okay, before I do that, let me show you a little bit what I was showing you before with concrete experimental plots. This is for bismuth 2212 close to optimal. This is a mapping of the Harpe spectral function as you move along the Fermi surface, changing the angle, and you see this reasonably well-defined peak at the node, and there's this very broad stuff at the antinodes. And this is also showing that when you go below TC, for this optimally doped compound, the quasi-particle peak comes back even at the antinode, but actually this is no longer true at very low doping. Okay. Electronic Raman scattering, so it's a two-photon probe. And basically, what I was saying is that it basically measures a stress-stress tensor. So it's not exactly density-density, but close. It basically measures how the system reacts when you kick it, more or less. And the form factor here depends on the polarization of the light. You can use this to your advantage in such a way that with this sort of polarization, you sample the antinodes. With this sort of polarization, you sample the nodes. Okay, so these are the first Raman spectra that these guys got. They've gotten many more since then. And that goes from slightly overdoped to optimal doping and three underdoped compounds.
So this is all electronic?
Raman scattering, yes. And this is antinodal physics, this is nodal physics. So what you see is that when you go in the superconducting state, which has the red plots, there is a peak that develops both in the antinodal for a while, then here it's gone, and also there is some hump in the nodal. That's completely expected, actually. Let me flash something which comes next. If you do simple BCS theory of a D-wave superconductor, what you actually expect is that the antinodal will be singular at 2 delta, that's the pair-breaking peak, while the nodal will have a singularity here and a maximum at like 1.7 delta or something like this. So this is more or less what you see, but, and there is a big but here, which is that this guy moves to higher energy as you underdope, while the maximum here moves to lower energy as you underdope. So it's completely impossible to describe these data with just a single scale picture where you would have a superconducting gap delta max cos kx minus cos ky, where delta max is a single scale behaving like the pseudo gap scale.
Unlike ARFES, this represents the two particle whole continuum.
Yes. It's a two particle probe, absolutely. But as you will see, this phenomenon also happens in ARFES, as recent data show. So the message here is that the characteristic energy scale in the superconducting state near the antinodes tracks more or less the pseudo gap as believed before, but near the nodes, there is a characteristic energy scale of the superconducting state, which is revealed by these experiments and which has a completely different dependence with doping. And actually, this doping dependence is to a very good approximation that of TC. This is mapping out these two scales from a bunch of Raman data, not only that, those of the Paris group, not only on Mercury. And you see that there is a very good correspondence between the antinodal scale and the pseudogap scale, measured by other techniques. And there is a very good tracking of the nodal scale with TC. So we believe that these experiments are actually telling us that the characteristic scale associated with superconductivity may well follow TC after all, and not the pseudo gap. The 2 delta over KTC ratio is more or less constant, but still pretty big as compared to BCS. And that, of course, you can speculate on the basis of that the pseudo gap has really a different physical origin than a precursor of superconductivity. Okay, so if you are not happy with this determination of the second scale, because after all, you know, it's just a small bump here, you can do something which is much more accurate and really probes the low energy excitations. If you look at low energy, all the responses in the nodes, because that's where the superconducting gap vanishes, that's where you have density of states, and indeed you see that this is more or less linear as a function of frequency, while this is much more like omega cube or something. And what you should be able to do is to do a low energy theory of the nodal quasiparticles in the superconducting state and track the characteristic parameters of this low energy theory, relate them to the slope of this quantity. So actually, the quasiparticles near the nodes are certainly described by a spectrum which is something like delta omega k proportional to v perpendicular delta k perpendicular square plus v delta delta k parallel square square root, where v delta is the slope of the superconducting gap as you move along the Fermi surface here, and v perpendicular is the perpendicular one. This guy is known not to depend too much on doping. So if you actually work out what the slope of the Raman response in the B2G geometry should be, it's going to be something like omega at low frequency times a quantity which is the square of the nodal quasiparticle weight times some vertex factor at the node that unfortunately we don't know, divided by V delta. And so actually a measure of that slope in absolute units tells you something about this combination of parameters. To extract that slope, you actually need to go through a long story involving some rules that I am not going to describe now because I don't have time, because you need to compare different samples, different dopings. So we did that.
Can I just see if I understand? So is the message that is accepted, is this like this year's D-wave superconductor, only the energy scales?
No. You are getting too far ahead of me. I didn't say it's a BCS superconductor, okay? I said there is growing evidence from these experiments and now also from ARPES and from other experiments that the gap scale is actually not what people believed, but actually is a scale that tracks TC. Now, this is still not recoupling BCS. That's very clear.
No, I want to say that in terms of Raman, if you look at this picture, it's essentially the picture you also see in experiments.
No, because this peak moves up and this peak moves down.
Energy scales go the wrong way.
Yeah, exactly.
But the message is that the nodal part is more or less like BCS.
Yeah, some strong coupling version of BCS. Okay. So you want to extract that slope, and when you do that, what you find, let me skip all this, what you find from experiment is that normalized to the optimal doping slope, this slope is pretty much constant. And so you see that if this was scaling like delta antinodal, okay, this would mean, since it's in the denominator, that this slope would go down, and especially you certainly expect z-nodal to scale more or less like doping. So this will be like doping square times something which is also decreasing with doping. So you would expect that slope to be dramatically suppressed as you go to low doping. And it's not. It is constant. So the only way to explain that is to say that since we know and we believe that z-nodal is more or less like doping, this guy also decreases as you go to low doping, which is exactly what I was showing you before, just by looking at the kink in the spectrum. Okay, you know what? I don't have any screen now here, so I don't know what I'm going to show you next. Okay, that's much better. Okay, actually this fact is not completely unknown, and it has been seen before in other type of experiments which measure the penetration depth of the superfluid density. And that was pointed out long time ago, 10 years ago, by Li and Wen, so it's a totally different probe, in which they pointed out that if you look at the linear coefficient in temperature of the superfluid density, which is very related to this, it's the same combination with a slightly different vertex factor here, What they pointed out is that this quantity as a function of doping is also pretty much constant. And actually, on the plot you saw before, there were both alphas and betas on that plot. And they more or less go together. Okay. By the way, for people who are aficionados of standard RVB mean field, of which I'm going to talk a little bit more about in a minute, this is a big problem for standard RVB mean field. Because what happens in standard RVB is that V delta scales like delta max, and Z scales like doping. So this slope should be dramatically suppressed, as I said before, and that's not seen. Why is that not seen? Because all these theories lack momentum dependence. They lack this momentum differentiation. Okay, so I'll skip this. A little bit after this Raman paper that we put out, came two RPES paper, which actually say basically the same thing. And that's very reassuring. This is also seen in RPES. These are remarkable experiments by Japanese and also the exchange group on very lightly doped LSCO, very difficult samples with TCs 30, 40, 50. And what actually these guys did is that they tracked the, that's actually not LSCO, right? That's BISCO, I think. That's BISCO. They actually tracked the quasi-particle peaks in the superconductor as you move along the Fermi surface. But the new thing in the experiments is that they can really go down to the nodes. And so what you see here is that if you are near the nodes, so point 4 here is very near the nodes, what you see is that the leading edge actually gets closer to a zero energy for the lowest TC samples, while at the antinodes, you recover that old phenomenon that the leading edge gets farther from zero energy. So this was one piece of evidence, and similar evidence came from optimally doped bismuth 2201, which has also a big pseudo gap, it turns out. And the story at the end of the day is that if you actually plot the leading edge as a function of angle, so purely empirically, you plot the leading edge as a function of angle, this would be antinode and this would be node, okay, you would be compelled to find in the underdoped regime that this does something like this, okay, with this scale going down as you underdope and this scale going up. But I insist on the fact that when I do that, I'm not just saying that, okay, the superconducting gap has higher harmonics. That's not what I'm saying. That would be interesting but not, you know, very exciting. What I'm actually saying is that this may very well be the superposition of two phenomena. One phenomenon which does something like this, which is the pseudo gap, and another one which is the true superconducting gap, which goes down as TC goes down, and that you see the sum of the two, and you are really dominated by the pseudo gap at the antinodes. Okay. So this is basically what I was just saying. Okay, so now I will go back to the board again, and I would like to switch into a bit of theory. I'm going to treat that guy differently. Yeah. Okay. So what I'm now going to do is to try to tell you what we can attempt to build theories of a doped Mott insulator which have very strong K dependence, which is the problem on the table. Okay, so first of all, some simple theoretical ideas about cuprates. You can view them as basically three-band models. And there are experts in the room, Tanushri, for example, so I'm not going to discuss that a bit. But just to fix energy scales, So three band model retaining copper dx square minus y square and oxygen states. And then the important energy scale from the largest to the smallest are, first of all, U on copper. This is very big. ATV, whatever, very big scale. Then we have a scale which is delta charge transfer, which is a few EV, which is the characteristic difference between copper and oxygen levels. Then we have a scale which is the copper-oxygen hopping scale, fraction of an EV. And then we have a scale which is the super exchange, which is of order TPD 4 over delta CT cube, and that's about 1,000 Kelvin. In view of this, you may want to eliminate the oxygens. You may or may not. Chanda Varma is not in the room, so that's all right for me. I'm going to eliminate the oxygens.
I'm too far away.
Okay. He may be right. So, you know, but just for all practical purposes, I'm going to talk about one-band models now. And when you do that, what you find is basically a one-band Hubbard-like model in which you have J of order T effective square over U effective. T is TPD square over delta, and U effective is really delta, roughly speaking. You're happy with that, Tanushree? Okay, great. And if you are more radical, you could even push this guy to be really large and say, okay, this is basically infinity, and you have a TJ model. So that's the simplest, you know, it plays the role of the Ising model of the field, something like that. Okay, so what can we do? Well, we have techniques that are specifically geared at low energy. And among those techniques, there is one that I cherish particularly, which is called slave bosons. And I'm going to say just a few words about that. Slave bosons are just a tool to build mean field theory and basically leapfrog to what are the correct low energy excitations of a problem. It doesn't really define what you're going to find in the end, because it really depends what you do with the slave bosons. There are all sorts of mean field treatments of those. But basically, the idea of slave boson is to extend the Hilbert space. So, for example, if we keep with the one-band Hubbard, we have four states per site. To each of those, we associate a boson. So this goes with a phi zero, this with a phi sigma, and this with a phi doubly occupied. That's called the Kotler-Rokenstein scheme. And what you do is you represent that state as a boson on the vacuum. You represent this state as a phi sigma on the vacuum and a quasi-particle with the same spin. So this is, I will use d sigma dagger for physical electrons and those guys for the auxiliary fermions or the quasi-particle operators that this formalism introduces. And this guy you will represent as phi 2 dagger vacuum times a doubly occupied F state. And there is a constraint, because the bosonic Hilbert space is very big, you impose a constraint to slice down the Hilbert space. And at the end of the day, most mean field theories would consider condensing that boson. And if you condense the boson, what happens is the following. Your physical electron is some function, let's call it square root of z, of the boson fields times the quasi-particle plus high-energy stuff. This quantity here, for example, would be just phi dagger sigma phi zero, because you can go from zero to sigma by creating an electron, plus phi two phi, phi sigma phi two dagger, phi sigma bar phi two dagger, because you can create a double occupancy by acting on an opposite spin. And if you condense the boson, this will take a vacuum expectation value. This is just a number, and that number is the square root of your quasi-particle residue. And you see that within such theories, this is completely uniform along the Fermi surface. So either these guys are not condensed, and you don't have quasi-particles anywhere, or they are condensed, and you have quasi-particles anywhere, and that's a big problem. Nevertheless, although a big problem, this leads to very nice qualitative ideas about what's going on. And this was done at the very beginning of ITC by many people, starting with Phil Anderson, who proposed this sort of approaches for this problem. And this would be energy scale or temperature versus delta, the general idea being that you have these various mean field parameters. What you can do is condense the boson. That will give you a condensation line like this. And you can also give vacuum expectation values to the quasi-particle amplitude. You can do two sorts of things. You can do this. This corresponds to creating singlet bonds. But you can also look at the anomalous channel on neighboring sites. And this corresponds to pairing. And when you work out the mean field equations, these two quantities actually happen below some line, which is like this. And these define four regions in the phase diagram. If you have quasi-particles and this is non-zero, you get the superconductor, so this is your dome. If you don't have quasi-particles, so if the slave bosons is decondensed, and this is finite, this is a state which is like a spin liquid, has lots of singlet correlations but no quasi-particles anywhere. This is something which is completely incoherent. It needs to be treated, including the gauge fluctuations. And this is a much more conventional Fermi liquid. And you see that to zeroth order, this is not too bad. It has all sorts of problems. I'm going to list a few now. Yes.
Isn't there a horizontal line distinguishing total incoherent behavior?
Okay, it's more like this. That's what you mean? Yeah, of course, there is a line here where everything becomes completely incoherent.
Yeah, because below this, that there is the strange metal with an F diagram.
Okay, yeah, but to describe the strange metal, you know, you need to deal with the dot, dot, dots here, right, which are the gauge fluctuations. Okay. So this has pros. This has good points and less good points. The pros I already mentioned. By the way, there is another one, which is that the effective mass in those theories is something like this. So this also says that effective mass enhancement in a Mott insulator with strong singlet correlations is actually not dramatic, which is good. But it also has cons. And there are several. It's not really a theory of the pseudo gap, because, you know, that's just a strange state where the spinons have a Fermi surface, but it's not really a pseudo gap state. The most important thing is that it has no clear nodal antinodal differentiation in momentum space. So in other words, either Z, the quasi-particle weight, is zero everywhere, or it doesn't depend on K when it exists. So the K dependence of the quasi-particle weight is just completely absent. It also has no lifetimes. And it has a big problem with the superfluid density, as I pointed out before, and now also with the slope of the Raman spectra. Okay. On the other hand, we have other approaches that are somewhat more sophisticated in the sense that they try to do something also not only with the low energies, but also describe something in the incoherent regime. And the simplest of those is dynamical mean field theory, which has been developed many years ago. And DMFT is basically being able to address what happens beyond just this sort of low energy descriptions. But the low energy physics of single side DMFT is very well captured by Kanon slave boson theories. So basically, the picture that comes out of DMFT of a doped MOT insulator is that you have a quasi-particle weight which is uniform along the Fermi surface and proportional to doping. Okay, so you see that what needs to be done if you follow that sort of route is include momentum dependence in these schemes. And that can be done by going beyond one site, because after all, we think that the correlations in the doped system are actually rather short range. And many people over the last 10 years, and Krish pioneered that, have actually investigated cluster DMFT extensions in which instead of just a single site, you look at a little cluster of sites, say a plaquette or even just a dimer, in a self-consistent environment. However, when you do that, this gives very interesting results that I'm going to flash now, but of course, it is still quite heavily numerical, and you need to forge low-energy tools to understand what's going on at low energy. When we were doing single-side DMFT, we were in a very fortunate position because all that stuff, slave bosons, were developed before. And, of course, Fermi liquid theory was developed well before. So we knew what was going on. And we could see that the low-energy physics coming out of the much more sophisticated DMFT approach was Brinkman Rice, was that sort of physics. However, the perspective is now reversed. We have lots of quite interesting numerical results in various groups with cluster extensions of DMFT, but we are lacking the low-energy tools to understand them. And so, yes? Okay, this is coming. So, what you need to do, for example, is to extend slave boson constructions. Perhaps that's a route. That's a route that I've taken recently to schemes that can account for the momentum dependence of the quasi-particle weight and that can potentially describe a state which has quasi-particles in certain regions of K-space and not in others. Okay, so now I'm going to show you some results using these approaches, and that will be the end of the talk. So I'm going to show you two kinds of results. Results that have been obtained using cluster DMFT. So what you do in cluster DMFT is you actually embed a small cluster, let's say four sites. We've actually also looked at just two sites, which is already quite interesting, in a self-consistent environment. So there are hybridization functions that connect these guys and connect these guys and connect these guys and are frequency dependent. And there is a self-consistency condition that actually relates this hybridization function to the full solution of the problem. What you really have to do is to solve a little multi-orbital problem. So that connects perhaps to the topic of this workshop, a little multi-orbital quantum impurity problem into a self-consistent environment and see what you get. And these schemes very clearly reveal that you are having a momentum differentiation in K-space in the normal state, but also, and these are recent results we got in the superconducting state, where the two scales that I was talking about seem to emerge from these calculations. And the second thing I'm going to very briefly show you is some results that were obtained with an extension of the slave boson concept which is able, I think for the first time, to handle Z of k's. And the idea behind that is very simple, but leads to rather heavy formalism. There is no chance I can describe it on the board now. But the idea is basically the following. in all these approaches, low-energy slave boson approaches, you see that the physical electron operator is some number, square root of z, which will depend on the condensed boson amplitude, times a quasi-particle operator. But you see that these guys and these guys are the same. As a result, this is just uniform. What we need is that this object here must be some matrix in real space. So let me call it R. It must connect I and J. And the quasi-particle index now is free to be different from I, which means that when you create a physical electron on some copper site, you also create a cloud of quasi-particles in some neighborhood in real space. And that, of course, will lead to some R of K, and hence to Z of K. Okay, so to do that, you need to completely disentangle the physical electron quantum numbers and the quasi-particle quantum numbers. And you cannot do that with the standard slave bosons because they carry an index N here, which is just the Fock space index of both the quasi-particle and the physical electron. So our idea, which actually builds up on some older ideas of Wölfle and co-workers, is to extend these guys to matrices where the first index is a physical electron Fock space index, but the second one is a quasi-particle Fock space index. Okay, so if you think of a model with orbital degeneracy, you know, N, in Kotlyar-Ockenstein, you would have to introduce 2 to the n slave bosons. And here we made a big progress. We're going to introduce 2 to the n times 2 to the n slave bosons. You know? By the way, this is very useful also in the context of multiplet physics, because if you want to deal with a multi-orbital problem with this sort of techniques, and many people have sort of tried to find ways to do that, if you have a problem which is fully rotationally invariant, you need a slave boson scheme which respects that full orbital invariance and can describe the multiplet. This is a scheme that can do that, while this is not rotationally invariant. You need to pick a direction.
What can this extension correspond to in terms of original auxiliary variation?
Okay, that's a good point. There is a paper by Michele Fabrizio on that, which connects the, well, establishes some relation between the two things. But, okay, I don't think that's fully understood, actually, at this stage. Okay, so we have a paper on the net that develops this formalism, and it turns out that when you use this to understand the cluster DMFT results, you really get pretty good agreement with the numerics, and this sort of allows you to start having tools to understand the low energy. The idea that we're actually using is still a cluster-based idea. This is not yet a fully lattice-based technique. Basically, what we do is, let's say we start with a plaquette like that. We actually diagonalize exactly the molecular states, the multiplets, okay, of that plaquette. That will give us some gammas. This, you see, builds up immediately the notion of singlet pairing and things like that. And we actually introduce a bunch of slave bosons, phi, gamma, n, where this is physical multiplet and this is quasi-particle, which we use as solvers within our cluster DMFT techniques. Okay, so let me show you.
In the slave fermion, you condense.
No, no, the fermions, okay. No, the bosons are all condensed. They are condensed. Yeah. Okay.
Stupid question. So the fermions here are neutral, right?
Yeah.
So the superconductivity is associated with the condensation.
Ah, okay. So if you need to look into the superconducting state, you need to introduce another matrix, S of phi, and have also F J sigma here, which we also do.
The question is it the condensation of charge E objects or charge 2E objects?
Okay. I actually don't know the answer to that. We haven't looked at the superconducting state with this technique yet.
But if I went back to the simple RBB...
I think it's a condensation of singlet pairs.
Okay.
on the bond. But
single pairs of what are the fermions? The fermions are neutral, right?
Okay. Basically, I don't know the answer to your question. Let's make it simple. Okay. So let me show you some results that are coming out of these cluster DMFT studies. First, in the superconducting state. Oops. So this is a work that has many co-authors, the first one being Marcello Civellis, that was his thesis at Rutgers. And what he did is cluster DMFT studies using plaquette clusters of the 2D Hubbard model in the superconducting state, solving the quantum purity model with exact diagonalization techniques. Okay, these are a bit cryptic plots, but what this basically shows is the real part of the diagonal of the anomalous component, the D dagger component of the self energy on a bond as a function of frequency here, and the low frequency component as a function of doping here in the superconducting state, because these studies find the D wave superconducting state as the ground state. And what you see here is that this object has non-monotonous doping dependence and goes down at low doping. And that's a hint that there is actually a scale, the characteristic energy scale, specifically associated with the anomalous component of the self-energy, actually does increase when you go to the mod state to optimal doping. I'm going to show you more of that in a minute. But actually, if you look at a different quantity, which is the normal component of the on-site local Green's function, which is something you would measure in tunneling. This is ED, so it has lots of peaks like this. But if you look at the distance between these two peaks, these four different dopings, what you find is that this quantity, which would be the tunneling gap, the one particle gap, has a completely different doping dependence and follows more or less the pseudo gap kind of doping dependence. So that's a hint that in these results, there is this separation of scales in the superconducting state. You can actually do a slightly better job, but to do a better job, you need to go really to real space, and that comes with various ambiguities as to how to periodize your self-energy. But when you do that, you can really identify a nodal quasi-particle with a z-nodal, which is more or less proportional to doping, and a slope of the superconducting gap near the nodes, my V delta of the previous discussion, which does something like this. So which has a maximum at optimal doping and whose shape resembles TC.
What resolution do you have in K?
Well, small, of course, because what cluster DMFT does is just include the first few harmonics of sigma of K. But that's the state of the art. Okay, so you can do two things. You can just solve your quantum impurity problem and look at the results without going back to real space and without bothering about periodization. These things that I was showing before were obtained in that way. So these observations are completely free of periodization ambiguities. However, if you want to do a better job and really look at nodal and antinodal stuff, you need to go back to real space or to the full K-space. Okay? And these quantities are obtained with certain periodization schemes that, okay, we can discuss later, but not now.
What is J or K in this calculation?
Oh, this is for somehow realistic parameters. I mean, this is, there is TET prime. And you. And this is all quite realistic.
Okay, so then if this on the rightmost plot, if I would think of the black and white points as representative of your pseudo gap.
Which ones? These ones?
No, the rightmost.
Oh, no, sorry, I should have commented on that. This is not the pseudo gap scale. This is the components of the Fermi velocity at the nodal point, parallel and perpendicular to the Fermi surface. This is just to show you that the nodal velocity does something like that, but the perpendicular velocity, but still at the node, okay, is bigger and more or less constant as a function of doping. Actually, there are much better ratios than that now with CTQMC that show that this is essentially a constant.
What I'm concerned about is that, you know, J is 1,000 Kelvin, and experimentally, you know, pseudo gap is of order of 300 Kelvin.
Mm-hmm. So,
I'm just wondering if in your calculation they scale, you know, and then the superconducting gap is the next.
They more or less fit. This is a reconstruction of the full one part, the full gap that we observe in the one particle Green's functions, decomposed into the contribution, which we call delta SC here, that comes from the anomalous part of the self energy, and the component that comes from the normal part. Okay, so this is the plot you wanted as a function of doping. You know, you have that scale, which behaves like this, and a much larger scale that behaves like that. Okay, so this is superconducting state. Let me say a few words about the normal state, and then I will stop. What the CDMFT or DCA or studies with these cluster methods reveal is that as you dope away from the Mott insulator, there is actually a phase transition at finite doping within the normal state solution. So in these methods, you can always study the normal solution. And there is a very clear phase transition. At low doping, you have a non-conventional metallic state in which some harmonics of the self-energy are more or less Fermi liquid-like with a finite Z and so on. And some other harmonics are insulating-like. So basically, this is very reminiscent of something that people have studied, and Zilker studied lots of that in the context of multi-orbital model, of a sort of orbital selective mode transition in which you have your various cluster harmonics, which corresponds to the various molecular orbitals of your cluster. And what's going on is that there is an intermediate state in which some of these orbitals behave in a metallic way, and some others are localized. So I would call it orbital selective mode transition momentum space.
I'm not sure if I understand. What are harmonics of the self-energy?
Yeah. What do you mean by that? What I mean by that is that if you look at a two by two cluster, you're going to have sigma 1-1, sigma 1-2, and sigma 1-3, right? Well, this is 1-2-3, right? When you go back to K-space, these are the three first harmonics, right? This is sigma 1-1 of omega plus sigma 1-2 cos kx plus cos ky, etc. Okay? So what happens, for example, here is that these guys are reasonably regular in this strange metallic phase, but this guy, it's actually more complicated than that. You need to go to cluster momenta. Okay? So you have various cluster momenta. Let me do it, actually, in a simple 2x2 cluster. It is simpler. So what you have, let's do just a bond. Okay, so then you just have two cluster momenta, 0 and pi. And what happens is that the k equals 0 remains reasonable, while the k equals pi localizes. That's what's going on. Well, if you go at higher doping, both harmonics are Fermi liquid-like.
What does it mean with 0 and pi are localized and delocalized?
Okay, so what does it mean is that when you actually go back to k-space, and reconstruct your sigma of k and omega, okay, you're going to have regions in k-space which have good quasi-particles and regions of k-space which do not.
This means that these have low anti-energy degrees of freedom.
Yeah, so this means that the Z, you know, has basically vanished in some part of k-space.
By non-quasi-particle region, you mean that Z is very small.
Well, it's worse than that. Now the statements that we are going to make are not free of periodization ambiguity. Okay, the statements that pertain to the purely cluster quantities are free of that. But if you want to go back to full K space, you need to periodize your self-energy in some way, and this is not completely free of periodization ambiguity. But what you will find in this intermediate metallic phase is that the only reasonable periodization schemes will produce a Fermi surface that breaks up. So it is not a Fermi surface that is like the LDA one. Like this, but it is a Fermi surface that produces pockets. But again, this is somewhat speculative because this relies on periodization. However, you may know that there is a very recent experiment by Taillefer and co-workers, just appeared this year, that actually has done a very beautiful thing, angular magnetoresistance oscillations in the presence of a strong field to kill the superconductivity. And they actually suggest that at low doping, this is what's going on. But now we are in speculation land, okay? And that the arc that actually people see in photoemission is this, while this is not visible in photoemission because it has actually very small spectral weight. Okay, you're taking me a bit ahead of what I wanted to say.
Also, what Maxime was asking me, is it a Fermi liquid even at the anti-log?
Okay. This is all a Fermi liquid.
But also up there?
Well, there are no quasi-particles there. There are just no quasi-particles at the anti-node. They are just gone.
So it's an insulator.
If you want, yeah. But the state is metallic, okay? Because it has quasi-particles in part of K-space.
We just obtain different shapes of the Fermi
space. Well. And lots of incoherent physics here, okay? I mean, if you really want to zoom onto where the low-energy Fermi surface is, probably you're right, okay? But of course, there is lots of frequency dependence in the self-energy here that these methods can calculate, okay? So this transition as a function of doping in the normal state is something that you actually see both in the slave boson calculations, in the low energy slave boson calculations, and in these full-fledged Monte Carlo, for example, solutions of these clustered EMFT techniques.
What are the slave boson results?
Okay, the slave boson results are, okay, so as a function of doping, what we've done is we've made comparison between two-site cluster methods, like both CDMFT and DCA, or aficionados, and using our slave bosons on this little molecule, okay, as an impurity solver. And what we find is that as a function of doping, there is a phase transition, which is seen in both, using both techniques. Here, both cluster momenta, k equals 0 and pi, are both metallic-like and, say, Fermi liquid. Here, only k equals 0 produces quasi-particles. And that is seen both in the numerics and in the slave boson calculation. There are differences. The transition is first order in slave boson, and it's actually second order in the actual numerics. But that's a well-known aspect of slave boson methods. Okay, so all this is basically unpublished stuff, so I think it was fit for this workshop. And as you see, it's still work in progress. The superconducting part of the clustered EMFT calculations have been on the net for a while. And yeah, that's about all I wanted to say.